morning, Your Honors. My name is Thomas Saunders on behalf of John Downs. Your Honors, within the limited time for argument, without giving up any of the arguments that I have briefed, I wish to concentrate on one issue, obviously subject to your questions on other matters. That is that the trial judge, in sentencing Mr. Downs, determined that he was responsible not only for the 1,000 and I think it was 21 grams.
22, yes.
That he admitted that he himself received from Mr. Jackson and distributed, that there was another approximately 3 kilograms that came in through Dulles that the judge attributed, and I believe wrongfully, and erred in doing so, to Mr. Downs. And he did so because of various calls that had to do with collecting of money from Mr. Downs. And I wish to pose the question this way. In those, Mr. Jackson talked about bringing couriers in and he needed the money. Let's assume for a moment he didn't. And he simply said, Mr. Downs, I fronted you these drugs. I want my money now. I need it. In that instance, looking at the sentencing guidelines, yes, one could infer a lot of things. But since he's a drug dealer, it's a good chance it has to do with paying for drugs. But under the sentencing guidelines, in the provision that I set out in 2A6, although I will note that both notes 5 and 7 there present similar matters, which is 7 has to do with a defendant's girlfriend who knows her boyfriend is handling large quantity of drugs, is asked to make one delivery and is held responsible only for that delivery. And in application note 7, a defendant is recruited to distribute 500 grams and knows that the person recruiting him is a big dealer, dealing in much larger quantities. Again, the application notes say you apply only that quantity. What we have here is, and it's included also in the government's brief at page 36, audio tape 5293, that Mr. Jackson was looking for, quote, a couple of thousand dollars in debt owed to him.
I didn't understand you to be arguing in the brief that this was just the repayment of a debt. That the $1,400 was made.
That is true, Your Honor. My client's position is that he didn't pay the money at all, and I'm not abandoning that. But in the alternative,
it's quite clear that he says he didn't pay the $1,000.
Yes, Your Honor.
That came up in a mobile phone conversation.
Yes.
But the $1,400, if he paid, he may deny having paid it, but did he ever say that it had anything to do with the claim or the request for $1,400 had anything to do with an outstanding debt?
Your Honor, the record is ambiguous on that, except for the fact that at subsequent phone calls, the question of owing a debt and all consistent with the time period when the couriers were coming in and needed to be paid. So that, although I grant that it is ambiguous, there is nothing to indicate that. I believe what the sentencing guidelines would say is that if you're going to be brought in, you somehow have to partner in some way, which is that if my client was called up and said, told him, look, I'm short, you know, I can, you know, I need 5,000 from you so that we can make this deal and I'll, you know, do good things for you, he suddenly joined. But if my client is simply a customer who is fronted and owes money and then is pressured by his dealer to do so and the dealer, you know, sua sponte says, this is what I need it for and I want my money, does that then make him liable for those larger quantities?
Well, in this instance, and to embroider your hypothetical.
Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose it's that the debtor, by facilitating the importation, will have, whether he facilitates or not, has a stake in at least a percentage of that because he will then be the distributor for that.
Well, in that instance, Your Honor, we could take every single buyer and say that that's the case, which is that if I'm coming to my dealer regularly to get, you know, an ounce of PCP every week, by the fact that it's fronted and I'm giving him money, I am clearly facilitating whatever is going on. And every single buyer
facilitates. At least to the extent that you have a stake in it.
In stake in that, I want to buy an ounce each time. But then, what we would end up doing is taking every single buyer and going up the chain and saying they are ultimately responsible because it's reasonably foreseeable that that dealer is going to buy in larger quantities.
You pointed out earlier that that Downs denies having paid the $1,400.
Correct.
But there is a finding to that effect.
Correct.
Okay. So unless you want to argue about the evidence supporting the finding, which I think you do next, the inference supporting the finding, I guess I should say, we're taking that as established.
Your Honor, I am not going to argue orally on that. I have argued it in the brief, and I wish to submit on that.
But the point that you were making about this being in repayment of a debt,
yes,
assumes there was a, it accepts the finding for this purpose and says yes, there was a payment. Assuming
yes, Your Honor,
there was a payment
for the purposes of this argument.
Yeah, okay,
exactly, because I think that's where, in my own mind, that the error of the trial judge in attributing is most clear. As I said, I'm not abandoning my client's position, but obviously, you know, I will admit that that's a more difficult argument to say that.
So here, I'm at now page 23 of your brief.
Yes.
And you say, Downs testified he met Jackson through his involvement in music. He was approached by Jackson and told Jackson could provide him PCP for sale. Downs had friends who smoked it and would say he would sell it to them. And here's the payoff. Regarding the $1,400 that Jackson requested of him, he testified that, I think that means Downs, testified that he did not owe Jackson that money and he never intended to give him the $1,400 and in fact never did.
That's what my client testified to.
Okay, so it's not only that he says he never paid, he also says he had no debt. So if he paid, it wasn't in furtherance of a debt.
Your Honor,
or in discharge.
Sometimes one has to argue against one's client's own testimony, and in this instance I am, because if you take the government's case, which the government is espousing as established, Mr. Downs was in a debtor-buyer relationship with Mr. Jackson. And so therefore, assuming that the judge made factual findings that the $1,400 was paid, he clearly discounted Mr. Downs' testimony totally. Mr. Downs said he didn't owe the money and he didn't pay it, and the judge discounted that entirely. So that if I take...
No, it's only clear that he discounted the you didn't pay it part. Right. No. I didn't pay it.
Fair enough, Your Honor.
I don't know what he thought about the debt.
But again, I think in terms of the record, we can take a look at the relationship. Mr. Downs was never characterized by Mr. Jackson as a partner in any way. Mr. Jackson characterized Mr. Downs as... He liked him. We did music together. He tried to help him out by fronting him PCP.
He was a partner in the music promotion, right?
True, he was. Okay. True, he was. So the relationship is more like Jackson's the big dealer, Downs is the hanger-on. He provides him small quantities of PCP to distribute so he can have money, and that's the relationship. Mr. Downs has not invested in or become a partner or in any way is going to profit. His payment of his debt to Mr. Jackson, as Mr. Jackson characterized it in his phone calls, does not entitle him to any equity interest, that he is not guaranteed anything in this PCP shipment. There's no conversation in which, because of paying the debt, Mr. Downs may have expected that he can, you know, buy again from Mr. Jackson, but there's no expectation that he then gets like a fifth, a tenth, you know, a 20th of what is coming in. You know, the record is entirely silent on his relationship changing in any way from the buyer-seller relationship.
And all of that is consistent with the subsequent telephone call after the May 12th call saying that the drugs have been seized or
yes,
the PCP had been seized.
Yes, I believe it is because it's just a conversation, you know, between these two in which these are the things, you know, they were friends and they chatted. Now, I'm not saying the relationship was good in that it ultimately ended up involving breaking the law with very serious matters, but that was the kind of relationship they had. Mr. Downs was a hanger-on to Mr. Jackson, who was a big player, who facilitated to some degree his music ambitions, et cetera, and provided him a way to make money illegally. I see my time is about up.
What are we supposed to do with the fact that if we accept your point so far and think it's a close call, our standard of review is clearly erroneous here?
Well, Your Honor,
this question or due deference, it depends on how you characterize it, and I'd like for you to flesh that out, what you think it is.
Well, very quickly, Your Honor, I believe it's important because the judge clearly even went below the guidelines in his sentencing here. There was 121 months, he went to 120. Now, and that's considering that he believed my client was responsible for 5 kilograms of PCP, which is a huge quantity. If you take out the 4 kilograms that came from Dulles, we're talking 1,022 grams, just slightly 22 grams above the, and you take down 23 grams and there's no 10-year minimum mandatory, which the judge felt was compelling to him at a 5 kilogram quantity. And the guidelines come out to, at that point, 97 to 121 months. So that I believe that
My point is on this factual question, though, aren't we supposed to give significant deference to the district court, whether you term that a clearly erroneous standard of review or due deference if it's an application of law to fact?
Yes, you are. Yeah, I mean, that is the case law. Mm-hmm. And I will admit this is a close case, but I believe it shades sufficiently into the point where the court should in essence, give the judge, the chance, because the judge was struggling with this. I mean, you can look at the transcript. He struggled with the issue of should he get acceptance response? No. Should he get the escape clause? There was a lot of back and forth. This was a difficult case, and I believe
experienced judge who's very familiar not only with the guidelines but the drug trade.
Yes.
And he heard the defendant. And he said he didn't credit his testimony that he was his own.
He didn't credit his testimony about a number of things where he denied a variety of factors. And I am, for the purposes of this argument alone, discounting my client's testimony and going on the government's case and saying on the government's case itself, it was erroneous to attribute the 4 kilograms that came from California.
Didn't the judge place some significance on the call immediately after the seizure?
Yes, he did. And the call immediately after the seizure was simply, you could view it as co-conspirators, yes. You could also view it as he calls him up, he's a friend, and he says, oh, my God, you won't believe what happened.
Right, but if the evidence would support the former, mm-hmm. then how is it clearly erroneous?
Well, because first off, my client had not invested. The loss of the drugs was no loss to him because he simply paid his debt to Mr. Jackson, and he's not a partner in whatever's coming in from California. The fact that he was informed of it would be no different. Again, let me go back to my previous example, which is
I understand you're discounting his testimony. Your client says, I have no $1,400 debt. Jackson says he needs $1,400 to get the couriers out there. Your client gives him arguably the money.
But I refer,
trial judge?
I refer Your Honors back to audio tape 5293, which is cited in government's brief at 36, where Mr. Jackson talks about money being owed to him as a debt, a couple of $1,000 debt owed to him. This is in the same time frame. So we're talking about the fact that, yes, the $1,400 is not initially talked about as a debt, but a subsequent call does talk about a substantial drug debt owed by Mr. Downs, if I may.
Mr. Saunders, before you sit down.
Yes, Your Honor.
At 24 to 26 of your brief, you're discussing at the top of 24, you quote the district judge's statement about the inference to be drawn and the reasonable foreseeability. This is on the scope of a co-conspirator's liability.
Yes, Your Honor.
But it's not clear to me precisely what the objection is at this point. You do quote the application note that deals with accountability, but as you mentioned at the outset of your argument, I think that had to do with things like repayment of a debt.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then you say that Jackson knew, brought large quantities of PCP from California to D.C. and continued to be a customer and pay for the PCP, that he knew Jackson did this, pardon me, that
yes.
Downs knew this, and pay for the PCP he was fronted, does not under the case law make him responsible for the quantities that Jackson imported, and then you're quoting the Third Circuit. What's exactly the fault you're finding here with the district judge's reasoning?
His reasoning was that the fact that my client knew that the payment of his debt was being requested by Mr. Jackson in order to facilitate the importation changes the equation. That is, because he knew that Jackson saying to me, you owe me money, I want it now, I need it now because of A, B, and C,
what if
brings him in.
If the finding or if the district court found that this was not in payment of a debt, or we can read the record that way because there's conflicting testimony and he apparently resolved the conflict, then is that objection met? Does it depend on this being a debt?
In all honesty, I believe it does. Now, I also would note that trial counsel conceded that issue at trial, and I believe erred in doing so, and I don't believe that relieves the trial judge of the duty to appropriately determine the proper guidelines. But the defense counsel did in fact say that that would be the case.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jay Appleson for the United States. Your Honor, if I may start, this was a factual finding with respect to the drug quantities that's reviewed on a clearly erroneous standard by a preponderance of the evidence. With all respect, the tape recording of the May 12th conversation reflects not that this was a drug debt that appellant owed to Jackson, but was an affronted agreement to provide $1,400 for the express purpose of having PCP couriers travel from Dulles to California for the very purpose, as the court found, to pick up additional quantities of PCP and return with it, and appellant was going to get a cut of that. On that conversation, Jackson says, dispelling this notion that it was a drug debt that appellant owed, to the contrary, he says, you can take it off of whatever I give you from the PCP shipment. This was not a drug debt, and that fact is confirmed in the recorded conversation that was presented to the court. The court's factual finding was not clearly erroneous, Your Honor. There was not only this conversation on May 12th where appellant unequivocally agreed to provide the $1,400 for the express purpose of the courier travel, but he confirmed his continued commitment, an agreement to provide that money the following day on two other recorded conversations on May the 13th. One of those conversations, when Jackson and he spoke and was recorded, he says, I'm out right now collecting drug debts from my customers so that I can get the $1,400 for you. And, of course, the original conversation on the 12th, the day before, Jackson presses him a number of times. Are you sure you can get me the $1,400? Because I need to go online tonight and make the reservations for the couriers. Jackson assures him, I'm good for the money. The airline records, which are at tab 13 of our record material, reflects that very night Jackson got on the line, as he indicated, on May the 12th, and booked the courier travel. The price of the courier travel was $1,454.20, almost the exact amount that, as Jackson testified at trial, that's all I needed to allow the couriers to travel to get the PCP.
When did this conversation take place?
The first conversation was on May the 12th, Your Honor, the key conversation when he indicates that
okay,
he agrees.
So why isn't it more logical considering the urgency of raising the money, that relates to the shipment coming on the 12th or 13th and not on the 24th?
Because the couriers were here, the modus operandi of Jackson and Jackson's organization was that the couriers would come from California with the PCP and remain for several days in Maryland. until they could get the sales and the money for another shipment, they'd send them back to California. And that's exactly, this was an ongoing
routine. So when he went online to buy the airline tickets, where were the tickets or for the, where was that journey originating?
Originated from Dulles, Your Honor, as reflected in the tab 13 airline flights. It was from Dulles to California.
Were the couriers based here or based in California?
I think some were based here and some were based in California. I think most of them in California, Your Honor.
So they were laying over a few days.
That's correct. And that was the,
but if they were based in California, why didn't they already have a return ticket to California?
Because they had to come up with the money to get them back. That was part of the, there was testimony throughout the trial.
Very efficient, lean, just-in-time kind of operation.
Much of it seemed to be that. Part of it was to make the sales, because they were doing two things, not only the courier expenses on travel, but also the money for the PCP from Tony Hilt in California. In other words, they had to pay the money to him, so they had to raise the money from the drug sales locally. The couriers would often remain for two or three days, was Jackson's testimony, and it was the courier's testimony that that was their routine operation. And the court found that this money was knowingly agreed to be provided for the express purpose of sending the couriers back to California for a subsequent PCP shipment.
If we return to tab 13 in your appendix, and I'm not sure where to find that.
That's the airline record.
Oh, here it is. I'm sorry, that's
the airline record, Your Honor.
Is there a page? I guess there are no tabs, actually, are there? They're just pages that say tab. It's an abstract representation of a tab.
I can hand the court. There is a tab that's not extending out from the pages.
It's a virtual tab.
Well,
did you find it?
No.
It's a page entitled tab, Your Honor.
I've got it. Thank you. So is this the ticket we're talking about?
Yes, sir.
This ticket seems to originate in California, not in Dulles.
Well, I think that's because it's done by internet.
Travel on the 12th of May from California to Washington.
Correct.
I thought I understood your answer when I asked you about why this conversation might not have related more logically to the imminent travel on the 12th or 13th. You said that travel was from Dulles to California, but apparently there's a ticket from California to Washington.
I misunderstood the court's question.
So doesn't that mean that they weren't raising money? I already had a ticket for travel on the 12th. They weren't raising money for that. They're raising money for the trip on the 23rd to 24th.
Well, exactly, because the May 12th conversation between Jackson and appellant made it very clear I need to send the couriers back to California. And, of course, they did, in fact, travel on the 15th. We know that the payment was not made immediately on the 12th because on the 13th, appellant was on the other recorded conversations still out raising the money for his commitment for the 14th, and they traveled on the 15th.
How much was the payment? How much did the shipment on the 24th cost?
The PCP, I don't know that that's in the record, Your Honor. If it is, I don't know it on the top of my head. As far as what Tony Hill was.
4,000 grams, what would that roughly be at wholesale?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Well, this is a $1,400 ticket, $1,444.
Correct. Jackson's conversation.
So if the ticket on the 23rd to 24th was, and I think there was a suggestion, it was about $700. And if that's the case, per person, I think there were two couriers.
Correct.
So if they needed $1,400 for the 24th, it wasn't for the PCP. It was barely enough to cover the ticket.
Well, the $1,400 was to get them, the couriers that were in Maryland, back to California, for the purpose of their then being there to get additional PCP shipments. And it weren't the identical couriers. This was a courier network that used a number of couriers. But the court made a factual finding that this money, or the $1,400, was, to, as Jackson says on the tape, to get my people out to California for the purpose of getting PCP and bringing it back. It wasn't until the 23rd, and the reason it was a delay to the 23rd, as indicated in another conversation, was one of the couriers, there was a problem, someone had gotten popped, and they had to go to a court, and they were concerned that they weren't available. There was a delay of what would normally be a return trip that actually ended up happening on the 23rd, 24th, late night on the 23rd. And, of course, there were additional discussions and additional payments beyond the $1,400. That was on the front end to get the couriers back, as the court found, but also the evidence that supports the $1,000 payment and the $3,000 agreement that were both the subject of recorded telephone conversations. Appellant doesn't deny that he paid the $1,000 and put it at Jackson's home under his trash bin at his residence. Jackson is also on the telephone with Tony, Hopkins, indicating that appellant had agreed to give him an additional $3,000. That was for the return expenses connected to the return before the 23rd.
Who were the couriers on the 23rd?
Franklin and Adams, Your Honor.
Familiar ring to it.
That's the only reason I remember it, because of the distinguished names, but they were not acting in a distinguished capacity here.
Well, I'm looking at their tickets for the 23rd, and those tickets are, looks like about $500 each, and they were purchased on the 23rd.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
But they're raising money, scurrying around on the 12th, trying to raise money, $1,400, to pay for tickets that wouldn't be bought until the 23rd?
No, Your Honor. The $1,400, as the court found, was for the purpose of taking couriers that had already come, and it may have been that very day on the 12th, as reflected in these records.
Yeah.
They were trying to get them back to California. That was the express, exactly what Jackson said on the tape. I need the $1,400 to get my two people out to California. The court so found.
Those two were presumably Anderson and Jackson?
Those were Anderson, correct, Anderson and Jackson, Your Honor. So there were other couriers that came back on the 23rd and 24th, pursuant to the modus operandi of the operation.
Well, it's still a mystery as to why be raising money to get them back when they have a ticket that was booked on the 12th.
Well, as any business, you have to pay for it. Part of this was, I think, on Visa.
That's true. It was on a credit card.
Part on cash. But you've still got to balance the books. And not only did he have to come up with the cash for the payment of the PCP, but he had to have his expenses paid for, as Jackson testified extensively at the trial, Your Honor. Your Honor, unless the court has any other questions, I would ask that the district court's judgment be affirmed. I thank the court.
Mr. Saunders, have any time? Mr. Saunders, do you need a minute?
No, Your Honor, thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Saunders. You were appointed by the court to represent the appellant in this case, and we thank you for your assistance.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both. The case is submitted.